Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the December 20th, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have Abu Muhammad al-Julani. He's the leader of the group Hayat Tahrir al-Shah, also known as HTS. And he's in his war outfit. He's got his left boot propped up on a tumbled head of a statue of Bashar al-Assad, and his left hand is a machine gun. His right hand is clenched in a fist. Behind him is another rebel firing at a building that has a large picture of al-Assad on it. And the headline is, "After Assad, Can Rebel Leader al-Julani Unite a Fractured Syria?" That is our first main story. We'll start right there. Islamist rebel leader claims victory in Syria. What happened? Deposed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad fled to Moscow this week after a lightning rebel advance ended his family's bloody half-century rule in just 2 weeks of fighting. Cities fell in quick succession: Aleppo, then Hama, then Homs, as regime soldiers abandoned their post in the face of the assault led by Islamist group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS. By the time the rebels reached Damascus, the government had already evaporated. Rebel leader Abu Muhammad al-Julani, went straight to the ancient Umayyad mosque to pray, while jubilant crowds began tearing down statues and ransacking Assad's palaces. The rebels threw open the regime's prisons, and thousands of gaunt men, women, and even toddlers emerged, with some of the elderly detainees apparently unaware that Assad's father, the previous dictator, died 24 years ago. At the notorious Sednaya prison, families of regime victims wept as rescuers recovered dozens of disfigured bodies. "They're all burnt corpses now," said Rima al-Turk, who searched for her brother. Almost immediately, foreign powers began bombing parts of Syria to protect their own varying interest. Israeli forces, seeking to prevent Assad's weapons from being commandeered by jihadists, launched airstrikes on chemical weapon sites and destroyed much of the Syrian navy. Israel also moved troops into the demilitarized zone of the Golan Heights, a Syrian territory it has occupied since 1967. Turkey, meanwhile, started bombing Kurdish militants' positions in the northeast, while the U.S., which has some 900 troops in Syria, struck ISIS targets. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, who tried to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria during his first term, posted online, "This is not our fight." HTS, a Sunni group that started as an offshoot of al-Qaeda but cut ties in 2016, has controlled Idlib province since then, where it ran schools and hospitals but was also accused of torture. This week it named an interim prime minister for Syria, Mohammed al-Bashir, who called on Syrian refugees abroad to return home and said that Kurdish, Shiite, Christian, and other minority groups would be protected. HTS's leader, al-Julani, is trying to project an image of moderation. "A new history, my brothers, is being written," he said. "This victory is for all Syrians." But he is still a U.S.-designated terrorist, subject of a $10 million bounty. What the editorial said. "For many Syrians, this is a moment of joy," said the Financial Times. The Assad regime was a mafia-style kleptocracy where The killing, gassing, and torture of civilians was routine. A member of Syria's small Alawite minority, Assad owed his longevity not to popular support, but to Russia and Iran. These allies helped him crush rebel factions after his 2011 crackdown on protesters led to a civil war that left more than 600,000 dead. But with Russia distracted by the invasion of Ukraine and Iran weakened by Israeli strikes on it and its proxies like Hezbollah, Assad's allies couldn't or wouldn't save him this time. Another regional power is flexing its muscle now, said the New York Post. Turkey is aiming to capitalize on the power vacuum by trying to take Kurdish-controlled Manbij. The Kurds are a key U.S. ally, and they hold tens of thousands of ISIS jihadists in their jails. While NATO member Turkey is technically an ally, too, Trump should let it know that any further action posing risk to U.S. interest won't be tolerated. What the columnist said. For Russia, Assad's fall represents a devastating loss, said Hannah Knott in the New York Times. Decades of Russian military and political investment to carve out a foothold in the Mediterranean, including coastal Russian naval and air bases at Tartus and Nemin, are now at risk. The Kremlin has made diplomatic overtures to HTS, Syria's de facto new rulers, but the group may not cooperate. It's an even worse blow to Iran, said Suni Ingel Rasmussen in the Wall Street Journal. Tehran has lost its only state ally in the region, its sanctions-flouting trade partner, its overland bridge to Hezbollah in Lebanon, and its staging ground for proxy attacks on Israel. Assad did nothing to win popular support, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Had the Obama administration backed a meaningful rebel opposition or enforced its own red lines on chemical weapons used in 2013, Assad might have been toppled earlier. Al Jolani, on the other hand, has been a surprisingly successful diplomat. He spent years laying the groundwork for this offensive, negotiating deals with Sunni tribes, minorities, and regime commanders to ensure there'd be little resistance. In the end, almost no one was willing to fight for Assad. Al Jolani now claims he wants to put together a government of national unity. Promises are easy, said Michael Rubin in the Washington Examiner. But note where Al Jolani delivered his victory address. Not the presidential palace or parliament, but in the Umayyad Mosque, the heart of an actual caliphate. That's a fitting representation of the Sharia law he plans for Syria. Remember, the Taliban in Afghanistan and the current Islamist-leaning government in Turkey also once promised to protect the rights of women and minorities, only to violate them once in charge. There is too much unfinished business for optimism, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. Al Jolani's vow to minorities may not prevent violent reprisals against the Alawite elite by the resentful Sunni majority. Turkey, viewing Kurds in Syria as allied with its own extremist Kurdish factions, is likely to try to create a buffer in the north. Meanwhile, there are Druze factions in the southwest, and Syrian opposition forces in the southeast, also jostling for power. For all Trump's insistence that the U.S. shouldn't get involved, it is America's interest to see Syria peaceful and politically stable, so it's not a source of mass immigration. Assad's ouster demands more engagement in Syria, not less. And a second main story. Suspect in CEO murder raged against parasites. What happened? The suspect charged with the murder of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson appeared in a Pennsylvania court this week and vowed to fight extradition to New York. As investigators there tried to determine why the well-liked Ivy League graduate allegedly turned into a killer. Luigi Mangione, 26, was arrested at a McDonald's in Allatoona, Altoona, Pennsylvania, 5 days after Thompson, 50, was shot dead by a masked assailant in Midtown Manhattan. The killer wrote deny, defend, and depose on shell casings left at the crime scene, suggesting the assassination was linked to health insurance claims, and fled the city. Police who arrested Mangione said they found a 3D printed gun in his backpack, along with a silencer, several fake IDs, and a 262-word handwritten manifesto in which he appeared to admit to murdering the health insurance boss and wrote, "These parasites had it coming." As police escorted Mangione to his first extradition hearing, he shouted, "Completely unjust," an outburst that fed his burgeoning image as a folk hero to some. Americans resentful of the insurance industry, those who knew Mangione, scion of wealthy Maryland family, were shocked by his arrest. He graduated valedictorian from an exclusive Baltimore prep school and studied computer science at the University of Pennsylvania. Friends said he changed after having spinal surgery for back pain in 2023. He became increasingly isolated and was reported missing by his family weeks before the murder. "I can make zero sense of it," said R.J. Martin, who lived with Mangione in Hawaii a few years ago. What the columnist said, "Why would this promising young man shoot dead a total stranger?" asked the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Suffering and lonely, he may have gone down internet rabbit holes and picked up the populist theme of blaming seemingly distant and faceless corporations for social ills. "But Mangione's internet habits don't reveal much," said John Herman in New York Magazine. "Yes, he praised the Unabomber's manifesto on a book review site, but he also posted about AI superintelligence and followed some anti-woke pundits. His online trail is just like that of millions of other young men in his social milieu." Investigators are eager to discover how Mangione got his weapon, said Maureen Cogan at Vox. "This may be the first high-profile murder committed with a 3D-printed ghost gun. These increasingly common firearms have no serial numbers, making them untraceable. In Mangione's case, the police, assuming they had the right suspect, got lucky. If there had been no gun in his backpack, they likely never would have found it." "Everything about Mangione is a mystery," said Scott Nover in Business Insider. "That makes it easy to turn him into something he's not, like a crusader for universal health care. All we really know is Mangione is a troubled Gen Zer who won the privileged lottery at birth and subscribed to a mishmash of interests and beliefs. We'll learn more about him in what will be a dramatic trial, but it will be hard, if not impossible, to let go of our initial assumptions." Controversy of the week. Health insurance. A CEO's murder and an explosion of rage. Elizabeth Austin understands why so many Americans reacted with glee following the murder of United Healthcare CEO last week, said Robin Abkarian in the Los Angeles Times. A single mother in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, Austin battled the health insurance giant after her young daughter, Carolyn, was diagnosed with leukemia during the pandemic. UHC first refused to pay for a feeding tube Carolyn needed to stay alive while struggling with the nausea of chemotherapy, forcing Austin to pay $900 a month out of pocket for the device. Then it denied payment for a sedative Carolyn needed during lumbar punctures. Carolyn is healthy now, but Austin is still scarred by the experience. She said she was saddened but not shocked by the shooting of UHC boss Brian Thompson and by the fact that his death was widely mocked on social media. UHC disabled comments on its statements about the murder after 124,000 users reacted to the post with a laughing face emoji. "These things are happening because people are really struggling," said Austin. "That's no excuse for this grotesque reaction," said Ingrid Jacques in USA Today. Thompson, 50, was a husband and father, yet people posted online that sympathy for his family was out of network or required prior authorization. "Such a shortage of humanity is alarming to witness." "Spare me the pearl clutching," said Arwa Madawi in The Guardian. "Murdering anyone is quite clearly wrong, but Thompson earned $10.2 million a year from a company notorious for getting its customers to pay enormous premiums, then denying one in three claims, a denial rate roughly double the industry average. He may have been a great father and husband, but he was also the face of an unfair system that has screwed millions of people over, setting them on the path toward bankruptcy, pain, and death through claim rejections. We don't know yet the motives of Thompson's killer, but the words left on shell casings at the scene, deny, defend, and depose, suggest the assassin shared many Americans' anger at a racket that is more focused on increasing profits than providing care. The reaction to Thompson's murder speaks to a sickness in our culture, said the Washington Post in an editorial, and to the widespread ignorance of how insurance works. Health insurers don't nix claims just to line their pockets. Their industry's profits, in fact, are capped by law. Insurers deny some claims, often for expensive treatments of limited effectiveness, because those difficult trade-offs keep premiums affordable while maximizing value for their customer base as a whole. Insurance executives make popular villains, said Dylan Scott and Vox, but they're no more to blame for our broken system than our overpaid doctors, congressional gridlock, or the fact that Americans are simply living longer. The failure of American health care is a collective one, and it won't be fixed by finger-pointing, let alone assassinations. The divide between those celebrating Thompson's murder and those horrified by it feels less ideological and more class-based than our usual culture war spats, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. And that's worrying. Class-based societal conflicts like the French Revolution tend to occur at moments of yawning income inequality like our own, when previously settled questions about fairness and the rule of law feel suddenly up for grabs. Whether or not Thompson's murder ends up being one of those historical flashpoints, we are crossing into dangerous territory. And our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Manifest Destiny after President-elect Donald Trump posted on Truth Social that it was a pleasure to have dinner the other night with Governor Justin Trudeau of the great state of Canada. Trudeau is Canada's prime minister, and Canada has not yet been annexed by the U.S. It was a good week for willpower. After a woman in Chongqing, China, won the first prize of $1,400 in a competition that required contestants to stay away from their smartphones for 8 hours without books or movies to distract them and without showing signs of anxiety. It was a good week for breathing space after Donald Trump named Kimberly Guilfoyle, the fiance of his son Donald Jr., as his pick to be ambassador to Greece. The surprise appointment came just hours after the Daily Mail published photos of Don Jr. holding hands with his rumored new girlfriend, former socialite Bettina Anderson. But it was a bad week for boldly going. After a New York woman whose license plate used to be NCC-1701, also the number of Star Trek's USS Enterprise, complained that she is drowning in traffic tickets racked up by scafflaw Trekkies driving with novelty plates. I've run out of stamps, said Bita Kouri, 76, of trying to answer every summons. It's a bad week for priorities. After news that a power outage in Springfield, Tennessee was caused by former Mayor Billy Paul Cornell crashing his vehicle into a utility pole while reaching for a breakfast sausage biscuit. Sources close to Cornell say that before he knew it, the pole was right in front of him. Finally, it was a bad week for Yuletide magic. After visitors to a beloved Christmas display in the English city of Winchester complained of a sharp drop-off in quality from recent years. Among other gripes, the actor portraying Santa allegedly has a blatantly fake beard and a cheap red suit and is not very jovial. And a short and other news piece. Biden scrambles to send aid to Ukraine before term ends. The Treasury Department this week announced it would send Ukraine $20 billion, its share of a $50 billion multinational loan, before President Biden leaves office. The Biden administration also approved a $266 million sales package to help Ukraine with the operation and maintenance of its F-16 fighter jets. The prospect of a second Trump presidency has thrown future U.S. aid for Ukraine into question and led the Biden administration to push every available dollar toward Kyiv to help it fight the nearly three-year-old Russian invasion. Since Trump's election win last month, Biden has announced more than $2 billion in extra aid for Ukraine and eased limits on Ukraine using long-range U.S.-supplied missiles against targets inside Russia. Trump insisted this week that Russia and Ukraine should reach an immediate ceasefire and said Ukraine will possibly receive less U.S. aid when he takes office. Moving on to the briefing. The resurgent anti-vax movement. Vaccines against childhood diseases are safe and effective. So why are fewer kids getting shots? How has vaccine use changed? Before the COVID pandemic, the U.S. was a world leader in vaccination with 95% of the population covered. Since 2020, though, uptake for all of the 15 federally recommended childhood vaccines has slumped by at least 2 percentage points, representing more than 70,000 children. In 10 states, exemptions from the vaccines required for public school enrollment now exceed 5%, the threshold for herd immunity against childhood diseases. And that means more kids are now getting sick. Cases of chickenpox, whooping cough, and pneumococcal disease are all up, and measles, which had been entirely eliminated in the U.S. in 2000, has come roaring back. More than a dozen measles outbreaks sickened hundreds of kids this year, concentrated in Minnesota, Illinois, Oregon, and Florida. If you asked me 40 years ago, would I ever have to be defending vaccines like I do now, I'd say you're crazy, said pediatrician Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine. Everybody knows the life-saving impact of vaccination. Why the drop in confidence? It's partly a result of families' concerns over COVID shots spreading to other vaccines. But the anti-vax movement started decades before the pandemic. In 1998, a little-known English gastroenterologist, Andrew Wakefield, published a study in The Lancet that linked the childhood measles, mumps, and rubella, MMR vaccine, with autism. Britain, which had recently mandated the MMR vaccine, was seeing a rapid rise in autism rates, with symptoms first appearing in toddlerhood, the age of vaccination. Concluding that the shot was responsible, Wakefield went on a media blitz in the UK and US, including an influential appearance on CBS's 60 Minutes. A few years later, Wakefield's research was thoroughly debunked. He studied just 12 kids, some of whom had developmental delays before they got the vaccine, and his work was funded by the very people who were suing vaccine companies. He was stripped of his medical license, but the damage had been done. Vaccine skepticism surged, and measles returned to Europe. Are vaccines actually risky? No. Over the past 30 years in America, vaccines have saved the lives of more than 1 million children and a lot of money. At least $540 billion in healthcare costs and trillions more in social cost. They don't cause autism. Scientists now believe that neurodivergent is 80% inherited, although factors such as advanced maternal age can also play a role. And adverse side effects beyond a sore shoulder are vanishingly rare. Fewer than 0.001% of people who get the Pfizer or Moderna COVID vaccine, for example, go on to develop the potentially fatal heart condition myocarditis. COVID itself is 7 times more likely to cause it. Still, some people say they have been harmed by vaccines. Just minutes after getting her COVID shot in 2021, neuroscientist Michelle Zimmerman felt pain rush up her left side. She was later diagnosed with brain damage and can no longer work. She believes she got one of 60 million contaminated doses of the since-recalled Johnson & Johnson vaccine. "The devastation of what this has done to my life," said Zimmerman, "feels too hard to comprehend." How did COVID spur anti-vaxxers? Anti-vaccine groups seized upon rare cases like Zimmerman's, as well as anger over COVID vaccine mandates, to undermine confidence in all vaccines. Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s anti-vaccine nonprofit, Children's Health Defense, more than quadrupled its donation intake between 2020 and 2021 to over $15 million. Another group, Informed Consent Action Network, doubled its staff. Misinformation from foreign actors online also fueled vaccine opposition. And pre-existing anti-vax communities found new recruits on Facebook and TikTok, targeting parents concerned about their kids missing school, as well as people angry over mask mandates. COVID vaccines have been the foot in the door for a more general anti-vaccine movement, said Dave Gorski, an oncologist at Wayne State University. And unfortunately, that door is open pretty wide now. How did the issue become partisan? The Republican Party embraced vaccine skepticism following the lead of Donald Trump, who repeated discredited claims on vaccines and autism during his first presidential campaign. That took this fringe issue and made it a political issue associated with the parties, said David Broniatowski, an expert in online misinformation. In Republican-led states, hundreds of vaccine-related bills have been introduced since 2020. While only a few of them passed, the ones that did expanded vaccine exemptions for workers, students, and even visitors to hospitals and nursing homes. Support among Republicans for requiring children to receive the MMR shot to attend public school dropped from 79% in 2019 to 57% last year, while the share of Republicans who believe parents should be allowed to not vaccinate their kids more than doubled to 42%. What will Trump do in office? The president-elect has pledged to make America healthy again by putting Kennedy, who claims vaccines have caused more deaths than they've averted, in charge of health and human services. There he would have the power to staff the CDC's vaccine committee with anti-vaxxers or even dissolve it altogether. He could also pressure the CDC to stop recommending certain vaccines, which would eliminate insurance coverage for those shots. What could change is potentially the cost of vaccines, the access to vaccines, said former White House health advisor Tom Inglesby, and also confusion about public messaging about safety. On the news of Kennedy's nomination, vaccine company stocks took a nosedive. If Kennedy does what he's said he will, said Lawrence Gostin, a professor of public health law at Georgetown University, he'll make America sick again. In the best columns of the week, first two come from the U.S. Three cheers for doxing neo-Nazis. America is a tiny bit better off because four neo-Nazis were stripped of their online anonymity last week, said Jonathan V. Last. The Texas Observer recently published the names of four ex-users who ran anonymous accounts spreading pro-Nazi propaganda and white supremacy. Doxing, tracking down and revealing an anonymous person's real name, usually carries negative connotations. But people should be responsible for what they say in public spaces. A person who wears a Nazi t-shirt on the street or shouts Heil Hitler will be ostracized, shunned, and likely fired. Rightly so. Internet anonymity, however, allows people to avoid social stigma by leading dual lives. These extremists can be far more outrageous than someone posting under their real name, giving them an enormous advantage in the attention economy. This is toxic. Partly through the influence of Elon Musk's ex, white supremacy has become far more mainstream than most people realize. Musk himself interacted with these Nazi accounts multiple times. While far-right Representative Thomas Massie, Republican from Kentucky, follows three of them. We need to reinforce robust codes of social stigma online and begin stripping the anonymity of idiots who are poisoning public discourse. Covering up the deaths of women. Abortion bans kill women, said Amanda Marcotte, but pro-lifers are trying to cover up that indisputable fact. After published reports that at least five women with doomed pregnancies had died in Texas and Georgia because doctors were afraid to treat them, officials in the two states decided to act. Georgia dismissed its maternal mortality board members for informing journalists about two of the 2022 deaths. Texas board, meanwhile, announced it would not be reviewing maternal deaths from 2022 and 2023. Conveniently, the first 2 years after the abortion ban went into place. These abortion bans contain a theoretical expectation for when a woman's life is at risk. But in practice, doctors are afraid to be charged with crimes. Pro-life activists now insist that if a pregnant woman is miscarrying, doctors should force her to have a C-section or induced labor. That can lead to uncontrolled bleeding and death. Christian right leaders like Ingrid Scott have proudly boasted that when women can't get abortions, promiscuous behavior declines. This is where these religious zealots' priorities really lie, in using forced birth to deter women from having sex, even if it kills them. This column comes from Canada. Why we aren't killing our CEOs. Canada can only watch in horror as America treats the assassin of a health insurance executive as a modern folk hero, said John Simley. When United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson was killed last week on the streets of Manhattan, many Americans responded with a weird mix of gallows humor and more radical sharpen the guillotine's menace. It seemed as if every family had a tale of exorbitant medical bill denied, whether by that particular company or another. I know this firsthand because I moved to the U.S. a few years ago, and I, too, have encountered a Byzantine, baffling, and maddening healthcare system. As a Canadian raised on our national single-payer system, I never even taken my debit card to the doctor's office. I was blissfully unaware of stuff like medical copays, premiums, exclusions, and deductibles. And I never had to pore over a list of different plans with varying costs during an open enrollment window, wondering how sick or injured I could afford to get in the coming year. The American system produces an ambient low-level stress, even for those who have so-called good insurance. Canadians should take this moment to appreciate what we have, a health system that binds the social fabric. When everyone gets the same excellent care, equality of all citizens is enshrined. That is a national good, and it's definitely worth protecting. Last word, our feature article. Mooding's 15 Minutes of Fame. A baby pygmy hippo has become the world's preeminent animal celebrity, said Stephanie Yang in the Los Angeles Times. Her zookeeper wonders how long the love affair will last. Chonburi Province, Thailand. Like most babies, Mooding spends a lot of her time sleeping. But for a few hours a day, the four-month-old pygmy hippo springs to life, gumming on leaves, zooming around the compound and tossing her head in a silent, open-mouthed roar. These moments, captured by her zookeeper at the Khao Kuo Open Zoo, a two-hour drive south of Bangkok, and shared on social media, have turned her into a global phenomenon, an It girl beloved for her sporadic fits of energy and proclivity for snapping toothlessly at hoses and knees. Named for a Thai dish that means bouncy pork, Mooding has become the muse for cakes, clothing, tattoos, and fireworks. Makeup tutorials demonstrate how to get her baby pink cheeks and dewy skin. Partygoers this year dressed up as the pygmy hippo for Halloween. So did comedian Bowen Yang on Saturday Night Live. Her remote home, struggling post-pandemic, has been transformed into a must-see attraction for international visitors and locals alike. When Dong Kim, a 29-year-old travel blogger, visited in October, the excited hordes reminded him less of a zoo than of a South American soccer game or a Black Friday doorbuster sale. I've gone to the Great Wall. I've been to the Colosseum. I've been to Christ the Redeemer in Rio. But this was by far the longest line I've ever waited in, he said. It literally felt like people would die for this hippo. But Mooding's sudden celebrity was not merely a result of cute animal worship or the fact that the pygmy hippo, native to West Africa, is an endangered species. While she was gestating in her mother's womb, a 31-year-old zookeeper was hatching a plan to make her a star, tapping into a worldwide culture well-versed in capitalizing on internet virality, and save the financially strapped zoo while he was at it. Today, Mooding is the most famous animal on the planet. For now. Nearly 175 years before Mooding took the internet by storm, another exotic hippo helped save the world's first modern zoo. The London Zoo began in 1828 as a members-only community, but opened into the public in 1847 in an effort to earn enough money to stay afloat. Visitors grew bored until Obaish, named after an island in the Nile where he was captured, arrived 3 years later. The first hippo seen in Europe since the Roman Empire, Obaish doubled annual attendance, drawing up to 10,000 visitors every day. They had to figure out a way to keep the public interested, said Robert Young, professor of wildlife conservation at the University of Salford in England. The thing they came up with, celebrity animals. Fans quickly grew attached to their favorites. When the zoo sold Jumbo the elephant to P.T. Barnum in 1882, people protested in the streets. A black bear named Winnipeg became the inspiration for Winnie the Pooh. Guy, a western lowland gorilla, received hundreds of birthday cards every year. In the 20th century, animals in the news, Seabiscuit, in movies and TV shows, Lassie, Punxsutawney Phil, captured the hearts of millions. Recently, social media has hastened the celebrity of animals such as Grumpy Cat and Jif Pom the Pomeranian. In 2017, Fiona the hippo went viral as the internet watched her fight to survive infancy. She became the biggest attraction at the Cincinnati Zoo, inspiring her own ice cream flavor and children's book. Leasing giant pandas from China has become another strategy to draw visitors. But foot traffic subsides after 2 years, Young said. While zoos spend hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on bamboo that the pandas sometimes refuse, pygmy hippos can be housed and supported at a much lower cost. Huanyan Zhang, a college lecturer at the University of Oxford who studies West African forest ecology, was surprised to see a sudden uptick this year in references to his research. He was even more perplexed to discover the cause was a pygmy hippo born more than 6,000 miles from its native land. It just feels like, out of many friends, one of your normal friends suddenly becomes a celebrity, said Zhang, who hopes that the world's love for Mu Ding will raise awareness of deforestation and endangered species. There are fewer than 2,500 pygmy hippos alive today, compared with 12,000 in 1982. Young said zoos often rely on ambassador animals to bring attention to lesser-known species. But social media, he noted, will always favor the Mu Dings of the world. The big issue, he said, is how do you get people interested in the uglies? Getting people to want to save a gorilla is quite easy. You try to get people to want to save the aye-aye, possibly the ugliest primate on the planet. It's a very different situation. 4 years after the pandemic choked off travel, the Kalkul's Open Zoo had yet to recover from the financial devastation. With only a couple of thousand visitors per day, the budget to maintain the 2,000-acre zoo was stretched to its limits. Anticipating the birth of Mu Ding, zookeeper Atipan Nundi sensed an opportunity. Nundi had studied to become an electrician, but his first job out of college was driving a 10-wheeler truck around the country. After 3 years, he started looking for something closer to home. The zoo, a 5-minute commute, had an opening. Over the next 8 years, Nundi cared for baby hippos, including two of Mu Ding's siblings, Mu Wan and Mu Tun, also named after Thai pork dishes. Though Mu Ding is known for her spunky attitude, Nundi said, her siblings were just as playful. So with one more on the way, Nundi was ready. I know when they become funny, how to set up the camera, which angle to take to see when it's cute, he said. Any animal can become famous like Mu Ding. It's just about how friendly you are with the animal. Mu Ding's celebrity did not start at the moment of birth. To his dismay, Nundi discovered her crawling around the morning on July 10th, placenta still attached. Their star had been born, and no one was there to document it. But in August, the zoo posted a poll online asking the public to help choose her name. Nundi's close-ups of her splashing in the water and snapping at the air started circulating on social media. Admirers called her sweet or feisty, or filled with silent rage. Japanese residents working at the local industrial park shared their fan art, boosting Mu Ding's popularity in Asia before her stardom spread west. By September, the memification of Mu Ding caught the attention of Molly Swindoll, an influencer who posts about baby animals and attending Taylor Swift concerts. The 29-year-old was so enchanted that in early October, she flew more than 18 hours to Thailand, stood at Mudin's enclosure for 4 hours, and then returned to New York the next day. She's absolutely iconic, Swindoll said. Whether it's a leaf being stuck to her face for a couple of hours, or her moonwalking, or biting knees, or running around with rage, she just makes you laugh. By the time she returned for a second visit, the zoo had implemented a 5-minute limit for spectators, after some were caught tossing water and shells to try to rouse Mudin. Swindoll still went through the queue 3 times, waiting about 30 to 40 minutes each round. The baby hippo's economic impact has spread far beyond the confines of the sprawling zoo of the Chonburi province. Miles before the entrance, posters advertise Mudin ice cream. The restaurants in the area fill up at lunchtime, and on weekends, makeshift stalls sell snacks along the road. The influx of tourists has boosted local incomes by 50% or more, nearby workers said. The month that Mudin was born, the zoo had fewer than 85,000 visitors. In October, total attendance rose to 300,000. Deka Santawanan, 59, spent about $1,000 to turn an old truck into a merchandise stall for Mudin pillows, keychains, and T-shirts to sell outside the zoo. He recouped his investment within 4 days. Now Santawanan, his wife, his daughter, and his son-in-law, who all work at the zoo, take turns manning the Mudin truck on their days off. Everything is better, everything's recovered, everything's booming, he said. Skyrocketing demand has transformed Mudin into a brand. About 70 companies have paid the zoo for the rights to print Mudin on products such as pajamas, pet food, and squeezable condensed milk. A supermarket chain launched its own Mudin-themed coconut juice after signing a contract that Monday afternoon, and a Thai business newspaper has reported that collaborations are expected to generate as much as $4.3 million by March. The money now accounts for 30% of revenue, according to Narongwit Chokchoy, the zoo director, with proceeds going to zoo habitats and living conditions, as well as flood victims in Chiang Mai in northern Thailand. We have to try to keep her fame and reputation going, he said, although at some point Mudin will lose some of her youthful bounciness and thus some of her charm. That's why the zoo is already pursuing its next viral hit. A pair of two-toed sloths is on the way, in hopes that with 3, 2 males and 1 female, the zoo will produce another small star. If so, the baby also will be managed by Mudin's keeper, who has enjoyed his own rise in fame, if not in pay. For now, Mudin is still going strong. Other baby pygmy hippos born this year in Sydney, Berlin, and Edinburgh have failed to match her allure. The Edinburgh Zoo promoted its newborn pygmy hippo, Haggis, this month as a rival to Mudin's famed cuteness. It later apologized for pitting the babies against each other. When a common hippo was born in eastern Thailand last month, she was named by an online poll, too, and christened Hom Dang, the Thai word for shallot. Pygmy hippo fans couldn't help but compare. One Facebook user complained that Hom Dang was too dry, unlike Mudin, who appears perpetually moist in photos. This one has no aura at all, another critic wrote. It's like comparing a celebrity to an ordinary person. This story was originally published in the Los Angeles Times. Here's a short health and science piece. A breakthrough for asthma attacks. Scientists say they have found the first new method in 50 years for treating serious asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, attacks, calling it a game changer. The new treatment is an injection of benralizumab, a monoclonal antibody. It works on inflammation caused by a type of white blood cell called eosinophilus, which drives about half of asthma attacks and a third of COPD attacks. In a small trial, 158 people who went to the ER for such an attack were given either standard course of steroids or benralizumab injection, or both. Over the next 90 days, those given the injection had fewer respiratory symptoms and were much less likely to need additional treatment. Scientists say the injection could be administered safely at home without the many side effects steroids can cause. COPD is the third leading cause of death worldwide, but treatment for the condition is stuck in the 20th century, said co-author Sanjay Ramakrishnan from the University of Western Australia, tells The Guardian. We need to provide these patients with life-saving options before their time runs out. In one of the Talking Points articles, Trump building a cabinet of billionaires. Donald Trump is assembling the wealthiest administration in history, said David Gardner in the Daily Beast. The president-elect has nominated at least 11 billionaires to top roles, including hedge fund manager Scott Bessent as Treasury Secretary, wrestling mandate Linda McMahon to head the Education Department, and finance exec Howard Lutnick at Commerce. Trump's cabinet picks alone are worth $10.7 billion, and that doesn't include his own fortune, $5.4 billion, or that of the outside advisor and world's richest man, Elon Musk, $360 billion. Added together, the incoming administration's net worth eclipses that of President Biden's cabinet, $118 million, and exceeds the gross domestic product of hundreds of countries, including Finland and New Zealand. No one should be surprised, said Eric Lutz at Vanity Fair. Trump ran as a populist, but he has always surrounded himself with other rich people and championed policies that serve their interest. He cut their taxes in his first term and will do the same in his second, this time offsetting the tax breaks with sweeping cuts to government services used by ordinary Americans. Don't let those dollar signs blind you to the rich diversity of Trump's team, said Gerard Baker in the Wall Street Journal. And by diversity, I don't mean according to the mandates of our DEI commissars, although he does pretty well on that front. Efficiency advisor Vivek Ramaswamy is the son of Indian immigrants, said, and Bessent, if confirmed, will be the first openly gay Treasury Secretary. Rather, this proposed cabinet contains a true diversity of ideology and belief, including traditional conservatives, national populists, and ex-Democrats. It's a broad church that, if you're an optimist, reflects the dynamic pluralism of America, or if you're a pessimist, will have the unity of purpose of a first-grade field trip. Senate Democrats should treat these cabinet picks as a golden opportunity, said Michael Tomasky in the New Republic. They don't have the votes to block anyone, but they can use the confirmation hearings to portray Trump's nominees as a bunch of out-of-touch plutocrats. Democrats should dig into the records to find out if any of the billionaires received a helping hand from government, a favorable agency ruling, say, or a soft plea deal with a prosecutor. There will likely also be skeletons in the rich corporate closet, such as evidence of labor violations or price collusion. If Democrats want to win back working class cred, they must remind Americans who the elitists really are. And a couple of short notes. More than 500 hospitals have closed their labor and delivery department since 2010, leaving most rural hospitals and a third of urban hospitals without maternity wards. Those units tend to lose money, Medicaid, which pays hospitals less than private insurance, covers 40% of all births. And running a maternity ward is expensive because specialists are needed for care round the clock. More than 77% of the Earth's land experienced drier conditions from 1990 to 2020 than in the previous three-decade period, according to a new United Nations report. Dry lands expanded by about 1.66 million square miles, an area nearly a third larger than India during that time. Donald Trump's inaugural committee is offering perks to donors giving upwards of $50,000. Those who donate $1 million or raise $2 million can attend events including a cabinet reception with Trump's nominees, a candlelight dinner with Donald and Melania Trump, and a starlight ball on inauguration night. On the poll watch, 62% of Americans think it is the responsibility of the federal government to ensure that all Americans have health care coverage, including 90% of Democrats, 65% of independents, and 32% of Republicans. 49% of Americans prefer a health care system based on private insurance, while 46% prefer a government run system. And we'll finish out the show today with a quote by Bob Hope, quoted in The Economist. He says, "A bank is a place that will lend you money if you can prove that you don't need it." And with that, we have, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. There we go. That's better.